We're all born here with this, what he calls the genius, which is the gift that serves you as much as it serves the world. And he said the step below that is the gift that only serves the world. When you find one that serves you both equally, then you will live a magnificent life. If you don't, it can almost destroy you.
Welcome back to the Wow Level Life podcast. I am Harris III, your host. I am so honored that you joined us for this episode as we jump deeper into a conversation with Jillian Farabee about the subject of curiosity. Now, we're not going to stay exclusively to curiosity. I could talk to Jillian for hours. I actually did talk to her for literally hours. And so we've had to trim this conversation down and just pull out some highlights because there is so much to share, both from her perspective, the story that she's lived, her professional experience from Cirque du Soleil. She is an extraordinary human being. But as a precursor to our conversation, last week, we jumped into some stories throughout history of extraordinary things that have happened in the world that are directly connected to the curiosity of a child. If you haven't listened to that yet, I would encourage you to actually press pause on this episode. Go back and listen to last week's episode. It's less than half an hour long. And we finished that episode not just by looking back on some stories throughout history, but by asking some questions to reflect upon, to anchor our thoughts around this subject of curiosity and how curiosity is simply wonder in action. One of the things that really stands out to me about Jillian's story is her ability to see the magic in others, in the stories that they're living, in the gifting and talents that they have, in a way that other people tend to miss. And I think it's a direct result of the way that she has exercised her practice and strength of curiosity. And so you're going to hear about that in this conversation and so much more. If you're not familiar with Jillian and her work, again, she is extraordinary. She has been featured on a lot of the stuff in our body of work over the years, from speaking multiple times at Story Conference to participating in SoloCon and some of our other events. She is a regular contributor to the retreats and intensives that we do with some of our coaching clients. She's just a really special human being. She went to an arts-based alternative school. Her dad's work moved their family to Jamaica. They lived there for 2 years, surrounded by the ocean, all this luscious nature and reggae. And eventually she returned back to wintry Canada. Right now she's been splitting her time between Montreal in Canada and Brazil. This conversation was had with her, I think, after she had just gotten off the beach and the coast of Brazil. And we talk a lot about her career, both as a professional dancer and actor, which began in her early 20s, to her time at Cirque du Soleil. She joined Cirque in 2004 as a casting scout and advisor. It was her job to essentially travel around the world and provide casting for the company's 22 unique shows, including the renowned The Beatles Love Show. And she was promoted in 2012 to be the director of the Creative Lab within Cirque du Soleil Media. And that's where she developed and co-produced projects for the international film, TV, and new media like VR, AR, Marcus. And again, that with all that was happening, as you would expect from Cirque du Soleil, such an innovative powerhouse, well before we all started seeing VR goggles for sale at our local Walmart and Target shelves, right? Way before it started exploding. Her highlights from that time as the director of Cirque du Soleil Creative Labs include things like the video game Child of Light that Cirque did in partnership with Ubisoft, the preschool animated series Luna Petunia for Netflix in partnership with Saban Brands, so many more. Inside the Box, Curios, the winning VR short, just a long career as a Cirque veteran. And she's also a certified coach, which is how I've benefited so much from our relationship and friendship. She was certified by the Hendrix Institute and a graduate of their 2-year transformational leadership program. Gay and Katie Hendrix doing amazing work. And then she opened a coaching practice for artists and designers and entrepreneurs like me back in 2012, and I'm honored to be one of her clients. Back in 2018, she founded Kite Parade, which was designed to bring together all of her years and experiences in storytelling, creative direction, large-scale production. And I'm so excited about the work that she is doing now. And so those are just some highlights of her long career. Now she is spending her days let's just talk about it in our conversation. I won't tell you much more. Ladies and gentlemen, here on the Wow Level Life podcast, this is my conversation with Jillian Farabee.
There's something that came to me when I thought about this conversation, and it was really just a way I would describe something I'm experiencing. But I think of you and I think, how would I say this to Harris, you know? So, and it was along the lines of what you're saying, this pressure that's in the world to have some kind of recognizable great life. You know, like whether it's success, whether it's beauty, whether it's followers, that this drive for what is my purpose, which somehow often has a sort of sheen of recognizability, which would then mean you must be in your purpose because look at all this success, you know. And I thought about in that is a feeling of, I don't want to, you know, a person or the theme, don't waste your life. I don't want to waste my life. And then I had this feeling for me, the word I would use now is I don't want to miss my life. Because, you know, I'm 59. Never even imagined that till I was like 55.
I don't even imagine you as being 59. You're so childlike and whimsical to me. And you have so much energy, not just creative energy, but physical energy.
Physical energy.
When I associate you and my friendship with you, I don't put you in that category of being 59.
And thank you. I don't even know what that means. And, you know, my mother was the same as me. And she was always like, her dentist thought she was like 70 and he thought she was 52, you know, and he said something about it. And I do. I have a lot of energy. That's a gift I've always had. And definitely I feel even more in a state of wonder on a regular basis, not just in front of what you would qualify as wonderful things, you know. And that what happens over time is really understanding. People say, you know, it went by so fast. I don't actually feel that my life went by fast. I feel like it has always been very like vital and vivacious and intense in a good way for me. Like very, very few moments have I taken for granted. I don't know why that is. Maybe having had experiences around death when I was young or whatever that is, or meditation maybe. And then I'm acutely aware of when I'm not with what is actually happening, because this moment isn't good enough. You know, this I'm trying to be somewhere else. So I miss being sad because I'm trying to not be sad, or I'm trying to not be bored. Or, and then the last couple of years, there's been a practice I have that's like, even if I say I'm being bored, and now I'm telling myself I shouldn't be bored, I should be doing something else. And I tell myself, oh, I should let myself be bored. I'm also saying, so that's what's happening. I'm having a whole conversation with myself about boredom and not boredom. And that's what's happening. That's what my life is in this moment. And I'm not divided. I'm in even the multiple layers or inner conversations, you know? And whenever I do that, it doesn't necessarily change whatever tension there is, or there's just something that goes, huh, like, ah, that's what's happening in my life in this moment. Cool. I'd like to change it. Okay, now I want to change what's happening. That's what's happening now. Now I'm changing it, you know? And it sounds kind of insane when you say it, but it's a version of living your life but not missing it, you know, which is very different than wasting. I think can be a feeling that you're not in the right place or you're not challenging yourself, or, but actually if you miss your life enough, you have wasted it. You know, if you're married to someone and you somehow don't notice when you're with them, that you're with them, even if it's a challenging moment, that you're with this person, you're living that with them. Then as you know them, when you have a good moment, you're like, damn, we are in this, you know, like you remember all of it, but then you were with them. And I think when they talk about people dying and saying, I wish I'd, you know, been more present, it's that feeling that you had a kind of value system about the moments in your life. And at some point you realize they're all the same. They're all your life. Mm-hmm. And that's the gift.
Yeah. But something special about you, though, is your ability to recognize that it's all a gift. I think it's easy from the outside looking in to look at people like you and go, Jillian's just so happy. She's so happy all the time. And there is part of that that's true. But yet you've had some extraordinary circumstances that have been incredibly challenging. You've had a lot of darker chapters of pain in both your personal life and your career. Mm-hmm. And so I think what's actually there, it's deeper than happiness. There's an unexplainable, seemingly unexplainable joy that you have that seems to exist beyond your circumstances. It's almost as if you choose joy, or that joy is like a muscle that you've worked out your entire life. And because you have so many reps in choosing joy, that you have the ability to show up in each moment and go, there's some kind of magic here to find and find joy in. What is that? Does that resonate with you?
It does resonate, actually. I wouldn't necessarily say joy in the sense of what people see as like joyful, you know, that kind of that energy. We're going to go deep already, but I'll say that's okay. It's okay. At 59, you're like, go deep, man. You know, it's all good. Interestingly, I'll say two parts to that, or two pieces. The first one is over time and living. One thing I do know that I have is when I wake up in the morning, or I realize that I'm going into a state of a deep, it's not even dissatisfaction, it's almost despair, or, you know, something where you're not feeling life and you're not feeling what you and I have, which is a lot of generative energy and activation energy. So when we're like, I can't think of anything I want to do with my energy, you know, and not boredom, but like your energy isn't moving in that direction, we know that's the beginning of despair or depression or what, you know, whatever you would call it. And I have ability in those moments to, it looks like that thing when the sand is going down through the, I don't know, or like in a pinball machine when they're finding their way down. Yeah. And it's what's happening in this moment. What is happening in me that's creating that? And there's usually a version of avoiding something that I'm feeling or thinking or seeing that I don't want to feel or think or see. So there's a moment of, until I get aligned with that being true or peaceful at some level that that's true, then I'm off. So I have a kind of ruthless, impeccable questioning of what is true. And is there something I'm not seeing that's true? And that's why I'm off the alignment of my life. So that's a practice that I do. It usually leads to what is actually the thing I need to do to get out of that state. It will lead me there. And it's that difference between avoidant solutions and solutions that go right to the heart of the problem and right to the root. And the ruthlessness is with facing your own self, you know, or just facing what's real, what's true. And then what can you do about it? So that, I think it takes some time in life to understand you have to have that courage. There are certain times when you, the darkness that you're in is just fear of facing something. And then you build the courage because it always gets you out. So, okay, here we go. You got to go in to go through and out.
Yeah.
Does that make any sense?
It makes total sense. You know, you're saying that it takes courage to face yourself. And I think that's oftentimes part of the reason why it takes so much courage is because a lot of us just don't like ourselves, or there's so much about ourselves that we don't like. You seem to like yourself. Not in a prideful, arrogant, like it's all about me sort of way. Like you're one of the most humble human beings I've ever known. And yet you genuinely seem to like yourself. Does that just come from age? Is that a choice? Do we all have the power to choose to like ourselves?
I don't know about everybody else because I don't. I'm not them. You know, I know for me, the liking myself, it comes from the gratitude of being alive. It all goes back to that. Mm. And the second part I was saying, you know, two parts is, I don't know if this happens with age or, and I feel a little bit shy to say it, but part of that deep joy, gratitude, wonder is the most complete acceptance of death that you can have. Because in that temporality, you know, terminality, if you like, it takes a long time to make some kind of, it isn't even just like a peace, because it's not passive, it's an active acceptance. And our brain really, we are not programmed for that, you know, and this touches on what people might call spirituality, or even the mystery of life, the things we don't know. And no matter how much we know about the size of the universe and black holes and all this stuff that explains all the way to an edge of something, then we don't know what comes after. Like, we don't know, you know, we don't know. And then death is a little bit different because it's sad, and we innately don't want people to be in pain and then to die. So not changing that humanness, but coming to some kind of livability and acceptance of it. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, strangely, you get so in love with life. It's not the opposite of what you would think, you know? You cherish it because it isn't even temporary. It's really actually only now at a certain level, you know? But at the same time, life is in motion. So it's not static. So that's like futuring. I don't know, maybe people who are monks or enlightened can be in a sort of perpetual stillness. But for me, life is in motion also. So there's discovery, there's energy, there's movement, and there's going to be an end. And it can come anytime. And so that can be paralyzing. I went through strong awarenesses of this as a child, and would, if I thought about it too much, would feel panic. So I reached a point actually when I was a child, like 7 or 8, and said, okay, for some reason, when I put that idea up here, it just paralyzes me. So I'm going to put it aside and I'm going to find those people that can help me with it. Because in my 20s, it would come in the night and I would be like, not sleep. And, you know, it's a longer story of, you know, all my steps. And I think people have different ways of coming to that. And so when you face that, then the best choice is wonder. The best choice is gratefulness, whatever's happening.
Yeah. So true. So true. I think what you're talking about right now is curiosity. I think of curiosity as wonder in action. It's just wonder, which is this physiological state. It shifts even what's going on inside our bodies. It's not woo-woo and soft like we used to think it is. It's like a real thing that scientists are finally studying.
Oh, wow.
And when it becomes a verb, it's fascinating because it turns in and shows up in the world as curiosity. And I think a lot of people, they think curiosity is someone who wants to know the answers to all the questions. Like researchers are very curious and they're able to figure these things out. I don't think that's what curiosity is. It's not a desire to have the answers. It's a comfort with ambiguity and questions and being willing to sit in the mystery. And so when you're talking about the association of wonder and terminality or death even, it's like there's a comfort that you have with the mystery of it all. And I think that's what scares most people, which is why wonder feels so threatening and disruptive to us. You know, if you think about this in the context of, you know, I did magic shows for 20 years of my life. Wonder gave birth to what people think of as curiosity. Like, oh, how did you do that? And when they come up and say, how did you do that? They think they're being curious, but really they're just trying to resolve the tension that they feel and the discomfort that's associated with being in awe of something, sitting in a mystery, sitting in the uncertainty, sitting in the ambiguity. It humbles us because they're like, I don't understand and I need to understand. Yeah. And I think that's new. 100 years ago, you couldn't go home from a magic show and Google the secrets. You just had to sit in the tension of the mystery. But we're uncomfortable with that now because we live in what feels like an abundance of certainty. But that abundance is, it's kind of an illusion. And so what I'm hearing from you, I know this isn't a total summary of what you're saying, but that you're wide awake enough to wonder, that wonder has given birth to a level of curiosity. And that curiosity is so genuine. You're able to pause in any season of your life and go, yeah, I don't know. And I'm okay. Yeah. I don't know exactly what the future holds, but I know I have agency to go create the future. And whatever I don't have control over or the ability to create, I will just enjoy the journey because it's the journey and the destination. I know that sounds really cliche because it's something we say all the time, but would you say that's true?
Yes. And I like what you're saying about curiosity, because I mean, the other one that you say in French, me travailler, but it means work on me in a way, like keep cooking in my life, was the word infinity. So, you know, death and infinity were these, like one is absolute and one is infinite, you know? Mm. And, you know, sometimes I don't talk about it because I think if I say enough, people will get as scared as I used to be. But if you're curious, if you think about that enough, you'll start to feel really scared, you know? Because it doesn't match even, I think, the way our brains work. Like in a way, our brain is an organ like our hand and it has a job, and that job doesn't have a button for the unknown, you know? But I think you can cultivate it. You can cultivate a way of developing that. And the thing that for me that death creates, if you're able to, you know, almost take it in small bites, it's not quite the right expression, but train yourself to face it, is that even when something that's very difficult is happening, you can sense, and it's not that I'm lucky to be experiencing it, but this is it. You know, this painful experience is today. You know, there isn't forever of days. And so can I handle this for the sake of another day and another day? And I mean, some of the most impactful things I ever said to people when I was younger and not even really thinking very hard about what I was saying, it was two people I know very close to me who were in suicidal periods of their life. You know, one where they were able to be home, but a lot of us, we were sort of rotating being with them. It was, you know, not actually in a place where they were being watched, like a physical place, but then also having people that were checking in every few hours for that reason. But as people mostly know, that a person can seem very normal when that's happening inside them, you know? So if they share it with people, then everyone's like, okay, we got to keep an eye here, even though this person can appear to be fine. And one of them, I said to him at one point, you know, we really can't do this forever. And at some level, this is your choice. We're here because we love you. But I wonder if there's anything in your life that you're really, really scared to do, but that you really want to do. And if you're considering ending it all, why not just do it? Like, do it, you know? Because you're willing to lose everything and not do it. Now, there are certain things that doesn't stand for, but in this case, it really did. And it was a career in writing that the person was terrified to fess up to. And, you know, and amongst the other things, the help that he got, he did end up in a very short time being awarded all kinds of things and created a career as a writer. So it taught me that death is this gift of, it really does all finish. And so is it worth cherishing even the hardest moment? Because it's an experience. You are still alive experiencing that. And there's something that I don't, you know, works for some people or not, but for me, it's not only about darkness. It's all the time, that feeling. And maybe, you know, 59 years in, it's easier because I'm not just trying to gain experiences. I've had a lot of great ones. How that relates to curiosity is you can still have fun looking for the answers. You can still reach what feel like answers at a certain moment of time. That's fun, but you're okay with the fact that we're not going to get it all ever. And there's a bit of an illusion, I think, in modernity that we are the highest evolution of life on the planet, and we're going to figure it out. You know, we're going to hack it all. You know, and somehow that's the satisfaction.
Yeah.
But it's the kind of it's illusion's the wrong word, but it's somehow a misunderstanding of the way things are more than right or wrong. And so that strange dichotomy, almost as you said, of knowing that there's no way of knowing at a certain level, but also having fun finding out.
Yeah.
Whatever you're going to find out. And creating the goal of discovery that keeps you feeling fully alive, but isn't so unrealistic in reality that you're going to be constantly disappointed or just never get there. And, yeah. And I guess you're saying curiosity is that the enjoyment of the discovery itself.
Yeah.
And that could even be enjoying a certain accomplishment, but it's probably more personal than, you know, all the answers to everything.
Yes. Yeah, I think so. There's actually a really fun study. I need to dig into it deeper. I just heard about it a few years ago and then got distracted, but you're reminding me of it right now, what we're talking about. And that is essentially they started studying curiosity, the type of curiosity that is most associated with creative thinking, moments of breakthrough innovation. Mm. And what they realized is that type of creativity and innovation is connected to this neural cocktail that exists inside the human brain. And so then they started thinking, well, what type of curiosity creates that neural cocktail? And essentially what they discovered is that cocktail isn't present. Those chemicals in your brain aren't present when we're just looking for answers to questions to try to resolve the tension that we feel of not knowing. It's closer to a type of curiosity where someone's willing to ask questions and go on a journey, but an openness.
Yep.
To maybe end up in a place that's different than than the X they put on the map, right? Yep. It's like, well, I don't know. Let's just ask the questions and go on a journey and see what we discover along the way. Versus, how did you do that levitation trick? Like, you got to tell me now. I must know the secret to the magic trick so that I can understand, right?
Yeah.
It's totally different.
I remember, I think it was Gay Hendricks, one of my friends and mentors, who said, you know, how, like, that kind of explanation is kind of a booby prize. Like, it doesn't actually, you know, it's sort of like, you know, once you know it, like, and in a way, as you said, it can even take some of the fun of the wonder, you know, the suspension of disbelief in performance language. But I think what you were just saying, like, as to my particular life, I mean, I'm reflecting on what are the things that happened as well as my nature that have created this you know, continuous excitement about life. And one of the things that happened when I was young, we moved a lot every 3 or 4 years into very different places, you know. And I was in one school in Jamaica and then in Canada in English, and I did really well. And then I was changed to a school that was in French, and then I didn't do well, and the teachers didn't understand. It was myself and a group that were put at the back table, and it was all newly arrived immigrants. So all of us didn't understand the language, but it took about 6 months before they got a tutor to help us. So we were just treated as if we were really stupid, you know, that stuff that you see back of the class, you know. But luckily I had been told and experienced enough that I was intelligent. So I just said, no, that's not true. I don't know what's going on here. And I tell my friends, this doesn't necessarily mean, you know, he's yelling at us and he thinks if he yells louder, we'll understand it. But it's all like Charlie Brown, you know, cartoon, like blah, 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 blah. This is, I don't even have any idea what he's saying, you know, and he's pointing and yelling, and that doesn't mean that we're dumb, you know. But that was because it'd been, you know, rooted in me that I wasn't. Yeah. And I had evidence of that. So that really taught me young, like, there's what I know and there's what people are telling me about myself. And so when I finished high school, I'd skipped a grade, and I was given a lot of opportunities in academic, you know, paths. And I took one of them, and then I decided, no, I really just felt like I wanted to dance and try that out. And you need to do that when you're young. So I actually said no to a scholarship, a pretty prestigious one. And this was like scandalous, like, you know, in that community, in my high school. And I did that a few times, and what I was really doing was, I somehow in my own being, I was saying, if I do what I want to do, really want to do, not a superficial kind of fulfilling a desire of the moment that's superficial, but what, like you're saying, the curiosity that makes me feel the most alive, and what can I do with my body in these like amazing dance circus extremes of potential, as you said, was really interesting me. And I had enough left brain logic to say, and my body's not going to be as capable to find that potential after a certain age. Now is the prime peak for that, you know? And so I'm going to go do that now. And then if I want to go back and do that later, it seems like I could, you know? And I remember being at a family wedding, and the groom who was marrying my aunt, he was very high situated academic. And he was like, well, Gillian, has a British accent. He was like, what are you going to do with your life, you know? And I was maybe 18, and I was saying, I'm going to start dance. And then, really, you know, why did you choose that, you know, as opposed to this scholarship? And I just said, I don't know. I figure, like, if I do what really makes me feel excited about life now, it will lead to the next thing. And each thing will lead. And then I'll end up being happy or just engaged, and I'll be having fun with life. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that one would just lead to the other. And that's really not what people are taught. Like I see when I'm coaching sometimes that what we're undoing initially is some story about how to build your life as an adult that was given to them, you know, in adolescence or somewhere when you start thinking about it. And it tended to be, you know, suffer now for a better outcome later. And then people will do a degree for 4 years and feel like, okay, now I can do what I really want. And sometimes the degree helps, you know, there's some element of it that serves, but I would see that they didn't get that message. And getting back to what you're saying, I think what I was saying is I'm going to prioritize that authentic curiosity, you know, because it makes me feel. And as you said, there was some really challenging stuff in my childhood. A lot of love and some dysfunction, and I was anorexic when I was 16 for a year, quite severely, and then was helped out of that. So I think I already knew that if you don't take care of that in yourself, you can go down, you know, a really sad and then unself-loving, even destructive path. So I'm sure that's connected. And that's never come back in my life. And I know for many people, it isn't that simple, you know, eating disorders. But I think it was that decision that made a big difference. You know, I'm hungry for life, and I'm going to do what I am drawn to, not just called to, but drawn to. And I felt like it was active and that one thing would lead to another. And that's what's happened.
Yeah. It's powerful to think about that decision that you made. Yeah. And I don't want to belittle it, but it sounds as if you're like, I just decided. There's a lot of people listening in, and they're listening to what you're saying. And they're going, it can't be that simple. Do I just decide?
I I'm going to be fair to them, to all of you out there. it was very difficult because some people were disappointed, but it was really considered, I'm going to use the word scandalous again, this, you know, in that, because it was a 2-year scholarship and I decided to leave in the first year and it was very competitive and prestigious. And it was a beautiful opportunity. And I got a lot through the first year. And actually what's interesting is almost 30 years later, somebody reached out to me from the alumni and they said, we'd like to invite you to an event, probably because I had a higher profile by then with Cirque du Soleil. Mm-hmm. And on the interview call, I said, yeah, I just want to make sure that you know that I left after the first year, you know, like, so I don't know if I'm the best candidate, you know, to promote the school or something. And they actually said that, I think he didn't know that and took a moment and then called me back and asked me more about it. You know, what did I think about that now as an adult? And they shared with me that in the 30 years, because I was in some of the first years of early years of the program, that many people had come back and said that it had been a very difficult time because it was such, the expectations were so high of those people that got in. And for some people, it was, they completed the years, but they had nightmares and it was difficult. And, you know, they didn't regret it later, but the organization had started to see some of the mental health stresses that it had caused. So they became curious about my decision. And then I went to this meeting of you know, sponsors and donors and it came up in the Q&A and I said what I said to you, that it wasn't that the school wasn't wonderful. It was that I just felt I needed to do something else. And several of the you know, top donors said to me, how did you do that when you were 16? You know, how did you know that? And face the disapproval of so many people. Like I joke, you know, I went into modern dance. I left it for that, which is like below poetry in people's understanding of why anyone even does it, you know, in a general
sense. It's gotten cooler over the years, to be fair. There's been some television that has been like, oh, wow, that's really cool. But yeah.
And I would say dance in general has gotten, you know, more that language, the nonverbal language has been, you know, understood and appreciated and enjoyed. And so it wasn't easy. I think two things. I really wanted to dance. And as I say, what I had gone through, what I discovered for myself, the source of that disorder, which turned out to be an eating disorder, but it can be many other kinds of mental health issues, was the therapist I worked with, which was very, it was very unknown at that time, you know, this whole thing. And there was very few therapists. It was like 3 in the country. And essentially he asked me, what is the thing that's so painful about life that you're not able to choose to stay here every day? And we explored that. And I found out what it was, both some things that had happened, but also how much I was being pushed because of my academic abilities into directions that weren't me. And that's how I healed those two things. And it was when I was 16, and I think it was actually when I was 17 that I said, no, thank you. And, you know, thank you, but not for the second year. So I think I understood if you don't, you know, the alternative. I mean, Gay Hendricks says, we're all born here with this, what he calls the genius, which is the gift that serves you as much as it serves the world. Mm-hmm. And he said, the step below that is the gift that only serves the world. But when you find that the one that's, you know, it serves you both equally, then you will live a magnificent life. If you don't, it can almost destroy you if you don't do that. And he quotes it from something called the Book of St. Thomas, which I think is a less known book in the Bible. I can look it up. So now I'm just discovering this as I'm saying it to you. Without being hyper dramatic, it was something like that where I knew this is what I want to do. And doing the second year is not that much what I want to do. I think the exception is that I gave myself that permission at 17 years old. Because when you're young, the idea is, yeah, but you just still have to do all this now and you get to really go for it later. You don't know enough yet to go for it. You don't know yourself enough yet to go for it. And I was like, yeah, everybody else's ideas didn't take me to a good place. So I'm going to take a chance that I do know what is going to make. It's not really happy. It's like you said, because curiosity is energy. You know, it makes you feel alive and it makes you, for me, this engaged with life is very important. if there's anything I want to serve right now that's been coming up really strongly, it's that there's a lot of things going on that are quite frightening. You know, when I was young, it was the atom bomb or, you know, there's different nuclear weapons. We can go back and trace that. I think it's irrelevant to compare. And I think the information era we're in is giving younger people who are less equipped in their resilience a lot of that information, you know, by design sometimes. And so I'm very aware of how do we give to younger people or to anyone who's feeling they just can't engage anymore. You know, they just can't find where that curiosity is and why they want to be here, not necessarily in a huge, you know, one sentence brand, life brand, motto, logo, mission statement, but today, right now, like right now, this moment, why do I want to wake up today?
Yes.
I think that's what the essence of curiosity is.
I agree. You said a word there that I think is really important a couple minutes ago, and you said permission. I gave myself permission, you know, and that was on the heels of me asking you a question about what gave you the ability to just make that decision that you just decided this is what I was going to do. And I think a lot of times the reason why those listening and may not make those types of defining moment style of decisions is because we don't feel like we have permission. We're waiting for someone to give it to us. And one of my favorite things about wonder is I feel like it is the state in which we have the most permission to believe. In a way, I watch wonder give people permission to believe. Because as humans who are uncomfortable, it's like we just want the proof. It's like, well, we say things like, I'll believe in it when I see it, as if seeing something can be trusted. Because again, it doesn't take much more than a few magic tricks to prove that we're not that great as human beings at determining what's real or true based on what our senses perceive. So scientists have partnered with magicians, and it's actually more true from those studies that seeing isn't believing. It's more true that believing is actually seeing, because it's what we believe that's informing what we see. And if what we believe is informing what we see, well, then we can't wait around to see in order to believe. We have to choose to believe. Well, choosing a new belief is really hard in a state of cynicism, which again is just fear kind of posing as confidence, right? But if we're in a state of awe, in an awe state, in a state of wonder where we're curious, it's easier to choose to believe in those states. It's easier to get that permission that you feel like you were able to give yourself in order to decide. Which might be a good segue into your time at Cirque du Soleil, because I feel like that's an iconic global company who built an entire culture around the type of wonder and awe that gave people permission to believe. And it wasn't just you guys as a team who had permission to explore any possibility, it seemed, correct me if I'm wrong here in a moment, but sitting in a theater and watching, not even watching, experiencing a Cirque du Soleil production, and it has inspired millions of people to lean into seemingly impossibility, to have permission to believe in a whole lot of things. And so I want to, by in no way is your time at Cirque du Soleil, though it is certainly a milestone in your life, the completion of your story, but it does feel like it's a significant chapter of your story. And I'm curious what we can learn from your experience there about what it looks like to live a wild level life. So maybe let's just start there. What is it about the culture that was created at Cirque du Soleil that gave people permission to believe?
Yeah, To go back, I would definitely say it is. I mean, when my time there was complete, and that was a timing thing for when the company had a transition, when it was sold, it was just, I felt in my life, you know, I want to try, it's time for a new chapter, but there was no, like nothing had changed, nothing dropped down, or it was just like that marker showed me, okay, this is that moment. And it wasn't easy, but it was again, that feeling of this is my curiosity is going somewhere. I don't know where, what it is. And it's not that this isn't enough. It's just, it's going somewhere else, you know?
Yeah.
And in that time, I felt I would sometimes just be walking down the street in the months afterwards and just have tears coming down my face of such profound appreciation, because the environment there was really remarkable and I think probably unusual in its own way. And part of that was a lot of us talk about it who've been there, you know, and some of it was just a certain group of people that just happened to come together at the same time with this very complementary set of extraordinary abilities. And I'm talking from the structural structural but innovative and fluid business approach to, you know, the courage and decision-making risk that Guy, amongst other people, has, and just so many different things. And then it started to attract a certain kind of person and energy. The main thing there was, and the initial, whenever I would start, these tears would start, it was that we got to try almost the limit of our curiosity on a regular basis. Like as far as you could imagine trying, somebody said there was a studio, there was funds, there was other people like you who had the same curiosity. So to live that for 12 years, you find out so much about this energy and about yourself. And I even built a, I'll say something in a minute, but I'll just say what I would call creative resilience by being in the environment where it could be continuously tested. And not tested like up against you, but tested like, this looks like it's not going right, but what if it was? You know, questions of, there was a lot of space and love of that space and trust, I would even say. And that starts with Uncle Dragon and the way he worked. And you could name all these people, but there was a trust of not even liminal, but transitional like spaces in creativity where something doesn't work. You don't just jump on it and fix it. You know, there's a moment of, okay, not even why did that not work, but could that be a better idea? We just can't see it. Like, did that not work? It didn't work how we thought it was going to work. And many other, I mean, there are so many examples of situations like that. I realized in the years afterwards that what one of the things it gave me that I think is the most important in life in general is so many times, and this happens also in my life, but where something happens, you know, you or I, this kind of creative, very driven by creative energy, we hit a wall where something happens that looks like it really just killed that thing that we thought was going to happen, you know? And it can lead to like, oh, I guess life itself isn't backing me right now, or I was wrong with that idea. And sometimes only a year or two later, you see that it was actually a pivot and it went somewhere better, but it took a while for that to show up or a while for you to see it, not just accept it, but see it. So one of the things I learned there over and over was the first question along with, ooh, this isn't going the way, this is failing, you know, or this is the wrong thing that to happen, to follow right with, but how, if this were right, what would that mean? How could this same thing be for us? Now it sounds nuts. And so you try using it and you have to really, like, you know, go way out of all your logical left brain and say, just give me a minute. And now use your creativity to redesign your perception of this experience completely. But if you were like the guardian angels or whatever that were really wanting this project to manifest at its highest potential, and you did this, you were out there, we don't see you, and you created this obstacle, where would you be trying to take us? You know, where would those magic fairies who maybe see bigger than us try, you know, however you want to say it, to help you do it? And that ability to change perception from the limitation of traditional thinking and just say, even for 5 minutes or a day, give yourself permission to not decide what happened here. And many times out of that came extraordinary better ideas. I mean, I can say one story. It was a really beautiful, all the shows were beautiful, but they were looking for the main character. And it was, you know, it's important to get everything built around that artist that you find. And it had the brief, and it was a very specific brief because what the artist was going to do had already been designed. The tram of, say, the tram, the show's arc, you know? So they need this physical skill, this ability. It's a big role. They need this many years experience, you know, on stage, holding the center of the stage. They need this height. They need all these things was listed. And it was age, height, background of training, etc. And so we defined those people. Some were already in the company, and we did these, you know, small auditions, and then we did different auditions with the individuals themselves, the finalists, if you like. And the director would keep turning to me, like I'm facing the artist, he's facing the artist, and he would turn so that only I could see him, and he'd go, "It's not it," you know. And I would go, "Okay," you know. And this would happen a lot in casting where you're given the brief, but you have to try to listen to what they're actually saying, not what they think that looks like, you know? And so again, it happened. And now the budget and the head of, you know, the one in charge of the budget and stuff, that senior director, what it was called, started coming to me and going like, you know, these people are all great. We need to choose these people. And, you know, this is just the director is just scared to decide or something like that. You know, these normal things. And I went home and I thought, okay, I know what I need to do. And I said to the budget director person, like, you know, if you can give me one more chance and I'm going to go way out, like wild card way out, but we're going to need to fly this person here. And I watched hours and hours of auditions. And this person was 18, was 6 feet, 6 inches lower than they said he had to be, had no acrobatic background, was a hip hop dancer, is now a very well-known choreographer. And I just said, I think this is what he wants for all kinds of reasons. We brought this kid in and in 5 minutes, he turned around, same thing. The director turned to me and said, it's him. I'm like, I know, you know? And even the more business director person said, I don't get it. You know, you said this and how is this going to work? And we said, let's just go get a costume. That's while the person's here today and put them in. And this person created that role in an iconic way and stayed with the show for 3 years. And it was all designed on his personality, you know? So I could have, after the, you know, the fifth or sixth audition of the perfect example of the brief, just started complaining and saying to my team, my God, this person won't decide, like, that this is a problem. You know, this indecision is a problem. But I went home that night and I said, okay, that, you know, that's, you can defend that point of view that it's a problem and it's not my fault and what can I do? Or I can say, where is this trying to take me? Where is this block trying to take me? And that's what I did. And I stayed up, you know, till midnight. And so that kind of went off on a tangent, but that's one of my favorite tools. Is it's really hard, but when something happens that you don't like and that feels deflated to the point of being like, I guess, you know, all those happy things I think about life really aren't true, or, you know, all that stuff that we do in our mind, all the things we're talking about today, they kind of deflate with this occurrence. And then you say, okay, but how could this be for me? And just open that space. You know? And to tell someone to do that with no evidence is like, yeah, okay, one more way to positive thinking, you know? But I would say that I saw it happen at Cirque because we were a particular group of people who don't give up easily at all. And so pushing is the first thing we try. But when that's not working, I would see this kind of, it was just like a moment of trusting the negative, trusting that, thing that felt like it just blocked the whole way, you know, or whatever.
Yeah. Would it be fair to say that it may not have even been a block or a negative per se, as much as it was just a mystery? It was just an unknown.
Exactly.
It's just like, we just don't know the answer yet.
That's a really good way of putting it. And when you open that part for yourself, then all the skill set of your professional ability and all the ways you've looked before and the ways you've done it, that knowledge starts to, and creative mastery, you know, meaning you've reached a certain level in this context, begins to work in favor of the mystery. That's what I would say. You know, not only starts to look on the edges, but behind, while you're sleeping, behind wheels, just start to, because I was looking through hours, but I had this guy in mind.
Yeah.
As I had watched the audition before and his relationship with the director was really fun and creative. I said, okay, my mind, you know, that's the skill that knows that that's also important, very important for a primary role, that the director is inspired by this person naturally, you know, because they're going to build a lot on them. Right. It's not taking it as the end of the road of the logical conclusion you had come to. It's saying, I don't know why it's happening, but I'm not going to decide yet.
Yeah.
The mystery is, it maybe, is it good? Is it bad? I don't know. You know? And I've done that with a lot of things in my life lately, the last couple of years, like really rigorously, you know, like, ugh, it's so clear that this is bad, you know, like, I mean, this is just, excuse me, shitty bad news, you know, and then saying, but I'm going to, you know, let that wonder. It is wonder. that wonder. And so many times from, you know, from airplane cancellations, one of those recently. And then I sat next to this brilliant neuroscientist and we talked for 6 hours about wonder in the brain. Mm-hmm. How was I ever going to get that with this person? I mean, I couldn't believe it. I was so kind of pissed all these hours in the airport. And I sat next to him and then we started talking. And then I was like, I found out his name and I know who that is. And I was like, I'm going to get to talk to this guy for 5 hours. That's why I missed my flight, you know, but that's why the flight was bumped. So
yeah.
I think that's like, as you said, it's easy to say, you know, just be engaged, just wonder, you know, and then it's also important to say it's not always that easy, but then what is something that has created that bridge to it becoming easy enough that you do it and you create a track record? That's becomes, I mean, you have that, the track record is the skill set really, because it lets you use it for bigger and bigger scenarios, right?
Well, and it's interesting to me anyway, to think about wonder as a skill. I think wonder is this fleeting momentary feeling that we wish for. It's like, oh yeah, like I took the kids to Disney World and we watched the fireworks show over the castle and I looked up at the smile on my son's face and I just felt this awe and wonder. Or I went to this incredible production. I sat through a Cirque du Soleil show for the first time. I was like, wow. And those are certainly experiences of awe and wonder for sure. But we can also solidify wonder as a way of being in the world. It's a way we can show up. And no one forced you to sit down and experience magic in a conversation with a neuroscientist. That was a combination of you being curious and going, okay, maybe this just isn't happening to me. Maybe this is happening for me. And different people have different opinions over, you know, why that happens. Is it some sort of divine thing? Is there a spiritual practice? Or is it just circumstance and chance, right? Maybe you were just lucky that day. But yet, despite why it happened, you still chose to engage. You still chose to allow your wonder to spur you towards the action of curiosity and like say hey to the person sitting next to you. And so I think that's the work.
Yeah. And so even as a storyteller, to limit the narrative to, oh, I missed my plane so that this could happen. As you said, it's almost too linear for wonder. So it's easy to be cynical about that kind of very almost pedantic interpretation. What I have experienced, because sometimes I don't get to the wonder, and then I see how it's by making that choice that I probably started talking to him. Because if I'd just been in a funk about that, I would have just, it was a night flight to Europe, you know, it was overnight. So you don't generally want to talk. You find a way. You know, you'd like, when you travel, like you tend not to start conversations.
Unless, we are skilled at those ways.
Because you're next to that person. And if they want to talk, you're going to have to be very unpleasant to get sleep, you know?
Yes.
So it was actually, I think something that was on his screen maybe, but I know that when it happened, I said to myself, like even in the airport, I remember saying, this is unpleasant, but much worse things could happen. I'm just going to be here a couple more hours. Maybe I can get some emails done. You know, that I'm going to stay in a state. I was very happy for the other flight. So I'm letting this occurrence diminish my enjoyment right now. Yeah. And I'm going to, the question of, is this for me? It's not as linear as for or against, you know, it's not really that. It's by saying, is it for me? You start looking for fun, for something, you know, and in that looking, it must have been something. And then I said, you know, oh, do you have a ranch with horses? Or I don't know what it was. And I wasn't looking for anything. I had just decided to be okay with this and be my usual self. And I mean, I don't generally start conversations, but I'm also pretty good at ending them. If, you know, you learn that skill too, to be very clear that you don't want to go to sleep. And then it just kind of opened up, you know? And so, as you said, it's not so much that it was to do that. It was just that after that happened, I saw the cancellation as a different thing, not just a problem. It was like an inconvenience and it turned to be an opportunity. So the next time that something happens and I'm perceiving it as an inconvenience, my first thought is, I thought something great was going to happen on my first flight. Maybe something great could also happen here. And then you're available, you know?
Yes.
And I'm sure there'll be a study on this, that availability for surprise, which is to me connected to wonder, it does, you do see things on the edges that you don't see when you've already made up your mind. This is not good. Like those edges have to knock hard when I anyway, have been like, I don't like this, you know? And so many times when I stay in wonder, then, you know, you get upgraded or not necessarily, I don't know if there's any correlation, but it's almost like you talk to someone with wonder and then they wonder how they can help you. You know, like, yeah. It's contagious.
That's what I mean when I say that believing is seeing, because I think it's easy to say, oh, believing is seeing. And what people hear in today's age is that sort of new agey manifestation thing. Like, I just got to believe that I deserve and am worthy of the private jet and someday I'll have one. It's like, that's not what we mean. It's that you didn't see someone to talk to. You allowed wonder to give you permission to believe in the possibility that there might be something here to discover. And that existing belief is what led to the seeing. It's what led to the manifesting. It's what led to the doing. So it's not that the belief alone brings the solution to the problem or the opportunity. It's what leads to you being able to explore it and be curious enough to find it. Yeah.
Yeah. And because I think that was in your book, it's not that seeing is believing. And I actually read the whole first half again about, I think, a month or two just before we came here. And that one stuck out to me because for a few days I was like, yeah. And it is something to do with that. We know this, you know, neurologically, that the net of association based on how things have happened in the past and certain activities and ways of being and even body mind exercises can open up new space for new associations. So that believing is just saying, all my experience tells me this is the limit of what is going to happen next. But I'm going to believe that there could be something else instead of being against me. It could be for me, however you're perceiving that. And by doing that, you literally see connections or possibilities that you wouldn't otherwise see. And the other part of the believing, I would say, you know, believing is seeing, is once you've seen it, you need to take an action step sometimes to get all the way to the thing that you were believing. So that's another thing with some of these manifestation formulas you see, there's some incompleteness sometimes. And they are also that there's no step for you to take, but there generally is a step of courage of some kind, or at least a little bit of discomfort, unfamiliarity, because in the limit of everything you thought was possible based on what you've experienced before, that also has all the things you did before. And now you're opening up, and now maybe you're going to do something that will be a little bit uncomfortable for that seeing to truly manifest as like you're believing and now it's true. You know, there's sometimes a little step, like despite what appears in podcasts and shows, I'm more introvert by nature. And so I could have said, when I found out this person's name, I could have said, oh, well, you know, I really admire you. Have a great flight. You know, like how would he be interested in me? And I just let myself like keep going a little bit, really reading the signs, you know?
Yeah.
And then we became like, he gave me this neuroscience term, hypomanic or something, where you just keep talking and taking different directions. And there's a word for it. And I was like, I said, I'm not always like that, but I don't usually get to talk to someone like you for 5 hours. I'm going to ask you everything I've ever wondered about this. And I wonder for you, because for me, it's very connected to surprise. I like being surprised, not like, you know, or not like necessarily surprise party, but I like being surprised that the world isn't what I thought it was.
Sure.
Like fundamental or not, or it's more than I thought, or it's what I understood and more. And wonder is the only thing that gets you there.
I agree wholeheartedly. And we were comfortable with that as children. Most adults are not, which is why so much about wonder is not the work of addition or becoming. It's work of subtraction and unbecoming. Because it's our natural state. Wonder is our natural state. And so wonder is not something you learn. It's that we have to unlearn all the things to get us back to that childlike natural state.
And someone said this to me, you as an adult, that process is honoring, almost defending, allowing, intentionally choosing what children don't have to try to do. You know? Intentional sounds the wrong word, but actually giving it full value and saying, I mean, I was doing that on the beach. What I do the most in airports is watch kids, because most of us check out. It's just such a kind of numb, liminal space, you know? I mean, sometimes I do a little stretching in the corner because we're standing here for hours and that's already like, whoa, you know, but as long as it looks like yoga, people are like, okay. And then you look at kids, you know, and they're like, we're all sitting in the chair. They got their head through the hole. They're lying on the floor. They got their feet if they're allowed, you know. And when you see those, especially the two-year-olds that just need to move, and you see those parents that just let them go and chase them around and get under the chairs with them, and they're just having so much more fun than anybody else in that time. Yeah. They don't know that they're in an airport. And it's one of the environments because the rest of us are being very serious, you know.
Yeah.
Borders and travel, and it's all quite, you know, do I have my passport? And there's just a lot, and am I going to hear the announcement? And it's quite a stressful. And they can make that fun, you know?
Yeah.
So yes. I watch them, and I mean, I don't do those things on the chair because unless when I'm with my husband, Eric, in the first few months we're together, I said, one of the great things about you is we can go in public and I can dance and move and be silly because you're talking to me. And so people think, okay, she's not losing her mind by herself. There's somebody talking to her. So some, you know, somehow you're like my legitimacy just by being there. You know? And so now we actually, you might see, we started doing videos of dancing in airports.
Oh, yes. I did see one of those.
And it's so fun. I mean, we don't do it like in the middle of everybody, but there's some great spaces in airports. There's some beautiful spaces, you know?
Yeah. At some point, I've got to get you back on the podcast with Eric and have a whole conversation around movement.
Yes.
But something you said, I love watching kids. And what stuck out to me is you spent a good chunk of your career, your professional career, watching people. If you think about your season as a casting director, which takes my mind to some interesting places. And like, obviously, we know you've been the one in front of the camera. You've acted on a lot of stuff. You've danced in a lot of amazing shows. And then you spent this little season at Cirque as a casting director and then moved on to a bunch of other things within Cirque and outside of Cirque. But if you think about the role of a casting director, which I've never been in before, you're spending so much time watching other people. And when I think about the leaders who are listening in, or even some of my own challenges trying to grow as a leader and as an entrepreneur, I think so much of leadership comes down to, if you could take it back to that believing is seeing idea, there's something that you're looking for, but in some ways you have to believe in it, which enables you to see it. And I think sometimes the opposite happens. We don't see something through our own little jaded or cynical or limited perspective in someone. And so because we don't see it, we don't believe that potential exists. And even if you go back to your story earlier where you're like, this is it. And the director's like, this is it. And you're like, I know. There's something that you believed and saw. So I'm kind of putting you on the spot here. This might be a tough question. When you lean into that season where you had to cast so many world-class performers, extraordinary human beings, in so many high-stakes roles, is there a practice? Was there something that you did that enabled you to consistently both believe and see potential that others may have missed? And if so, what was it? And how can we apply it to our own life and leadership so that we don't miss out on seeing that same potential in those around us?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And there was a lot I learned about that through the casting itself. And there's other things that I learned about the casting as well. But as you said, you know, watching a lot of videos, that's a little bit different. Getting to the point where you invite the 100, 200, 300. And then, as you know, there's you know, you do a couple of hours and then you do a cut. Now people have seen all these audition shows. So now there's a more understanding of the practice. The thing that I would say, one thing is passion and originality. Those two things you can see even before skill has caught up. So I would go to see a lot of shows. I would run the auditions, but also we scouted a lot of festivals and all kinds of different events where you would get to see performers. And you can see that in a young performer. When they put their foot on the stage and they just light up and they are in the right place, no matter how awkward or how well it's going that day, you know, so they may be not quite as skilled yet, but that goes a long way. When it's, as I said, you see that moment where they are loving it as much as you are loving it. And when they do it, they're as happy as the other people when they're doing it well. So that's a kind of bank of energy that you can count on. And Cirque is a long haul. In a good way, like you are going to work for 9 months 8 hours a day on this show, then you're going to tour. So if people have that passion, that's already clear. And then originality sometimes shows up in the context of an audition because you're doing a certain sequence to evaluate certain things, and this person isn't fitting any of those. But the way they're not fitting keeps catching your eye. The way they're failing is catching your eye more than the people who are succeeding in the exercise or whatever, you know? So you notice what catches your human interest, and originality always does. It always does. Now, if they also have that passion and willingness, then you can bring somebody because you can train somebody skill-wise. You can't create. If somebody is in an artistic field, maybe not what they really love, but they're in it for some other reason. They spent years going to school or, you know, their parents wanted them to. So you look for that thing that is a generator in themselves. And then the thing that people who don't do casting a lot don't understand is to look for that originality, because the audience doesn't really know whether that foot should be pointed a little bit more. Like, that's something I really learned after being a dancer in ballet, where we obsess on perfection. And the only people in the audience who care are other dancers. Or dancers. The audience just thinks what you're doing is amazing, and they want to see if you have charisma, and if you're excited, and if you're musical or whatever else is coming out of your interpretation. So that's the other thing. The last thing I'll say that's more for leaders is, so you see these videos or the people's, you know, reel, and then you do the first, generally you start with skills at the beginning, you know, just to see where they're at. Then you might do a choreography or something that is similar to what's on a show. Then you would do an actual excerpt from the show. That's the first day. And you cut after each of those exercises. You let people go who didn't fulfill the need, or they look like their alignment's off. So no matter how good they are, they're going to get injured doing 10 shows a week. So, and then the second day you might do something like improvisation. And then we generally would do group exercises to see who needs to be the soloist and maybe isn't going to work well in a big group and all of that, you know? And people surprise you all the time. Like, we would watch the videos, and then we have our 100 people, and the two people, I'm going there live, and my other maybe partner is helping me choose. And we always say, we think these two are going to blow it. You know, they're for sure going to get to the end, right? Or they're going to like make it fun. And then, you know, you always think you know what's going to happen. And what surprises you is you're generally right in the ballpark field. Sometimes someone surprises you, a wild card. But what would always surprise me is the people who just eke in over that cut, and then they blow it, you know, the next 2 hours, they're suddenly the top. And we just barely decided to let them through, you know. Mm-hmm. And that has to do with psychology. Like, that some people, they are like, they come in, you know, like, I got the goods. And you're like, you sure do, thank God, because everyone else is trembling. And then that, then kind of like by the third, that was it. There's no, nothing more per se. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's enough, you know, but that's it, you know, great. That's mm-hmm. what we need. And then other people, it's just when they get asked back and they go, oh, you like me, you know, and then it comes up. And then the second day is when people really, you really know what's happening, the beginning of the second day, mm-hmm. because they get to sleep on the fact that they were chosen, and maybe they won't make it till the end, but they're coming into the room knowing you like something about them. The people who kind of always knew you were going to like something, sometimes they don't try, or they just, you know, they're just kind of front runner people, but that's okay if everything works, you know. But the one that you learn over time to always let through that person that you don't know.
There's so many applications of this. One of the things that I think storytellers often do is we tell an amazing story, or even as communicators, we communicate a powerful idea. And then we go, okay, now just, I don't want to make sure that you guys don't miss this. And so out of a lack of trust for the audience and their, you know, inherent wisdom and intelligence, we go, and the moral of the story is, and so I don't want to like sabotage the application here, but like, this has so much application in everything from leadership with inside organizations and how we call people back by letting them know, hey, like, we're interested, like, you've been chosen to come back for day two. Versus how many sweeping judgments we make too quickly because we're not curious enough, down to even like dating relationships and like single people who might be listening in who really want to be in a relationship. And even going back to the originality that you were talking about, where my mind went curiously was like, okay, if it's originality that's standing out to you, that's we can't look for it. It's literally the definition of originality. It's so original that it couldn't go in the, what do they call it when you call for auditions? It's like, here's the little synopsis of what we're looking at, the brief. Yeah. So it's like you write the brief. You can't write that originality into the brief because it's theirs. It's their originality. And like, even if you think about from a dating perspective, it's like, okay, we all have this like blueprint, this brief, this dating brief of like, here's what I'm looking for. And like, how much magic and other people are we missing in every single facet of life and work and relationships simply because we're going, oh, that's not what I'm looking for. And yet, well, it's not what you were looking for, but you're missing the magic that's right there because you have this little set of expectations. And I think that's what wonder does. It's like in a state of wonder, it's like our clenched fists on our expectations, like those start to dissolve and we're just kind of open to the ambiguity of like, I don't know. What if there's something here that I'm not seeing? And I think your openness to that is what allowed you to contribute in an extraordinary way to extraordinary accomplishments of an entire company. It's like a willingness to hold space for that, a willingness to be surprised by that.
And also one of the, you know, they weren't called brand pillars yet, but one of the things we were always told, and this was known about Cirque, and it came directly from Guy over and over again, I want you to find things that nobody's ever seen before. So, you know, that was the contortionist from Mongolia that had never been in a Western circus from what I remember hearing. Now, when YouTube came along, it became a little harder for us because you could see so much.
Sure.
But that was in there. Like, find something that, as you said, can't be in the brief because it's the unexpected for everybody, you know? Mm-hmm. And that, those people, the quirky people are often a little quieter because they've been told so often that they're weird or they're, you know, that kind of dichotomy in a way. Because most, you know, generally in the arts, people aren't looking for that, you know? That's one of the gifts of the real art of casting. You know, they always tell the story of The Graduate, that, you know, Dustin Hoffman was not what anybody was looking for. And this very famous casting person put him on the table and the whole story changed, you know, and became something that is more iconic and memorable. And another thing that I thought of to say is, because I had been a performer, when I started running castings, I said to my director, and I think I might even said this in my last interview for the job, I said, you know, we hide information sometimes from artists because there's stories that they're very emotional and, you know, this is a stressful situation. We have their dream in our hands. And so, you know, but I remember saying, I would start each audition with, all of you got this far and all of you are artists. There's no question. And I'm here to run this audition and make choices. And to some degree, my choices are subjective because every human being is subjective. And also, my mandate is to find what I think fits Cirque du Soleil. And there's some of you that I might choose if I was a choreographer, but right now I wouldn't choose you for this company. And again, that's subjective. So starting with the first cut, after the cut, I would be available for 15 minutes to answer if anyone wanted to come up and say, why did you cut me? Because all artists evolve, I've evolved. And I said to the director, if they don't ask me, they're going to make up a story what they think it is. And it could not be the right story. They can't work on it and come back in a year and have us hire them. So many artists I auditioned 2 and 3 times and they were cast the third time. And so that people don't usually do that. They think, oh, we held accountable or whatever, you know. And I remember the first artist who came up to me was a dancer in the Czech Republic. And, you know, people, some don't come, they want to, you know, the whole line, you see it all. And she came up a little bit like, well, I wasn't going to stay, but okay, the other person already answered and I'm here. So you can read like, okay, there's a lot going on here before the question, you know? And then she said, I know that I'm too heavy and I'm never going to get a job as a dancer. And I know I have to lose weight. I'm not the usual body type, but I just thought I'd ask anyway, you know? And I said, no, actually, that might be true in some dance environments, but you're strong. And that is more what we need, you know? So that wasn't on my mind at all. I said, what it was you're very green. You're not even finished your last year of school. And this is a really high level professional company. So to put you in this environment would be a little bit possibly disorienting. The demands, you know, understanding everything that's happening. I'm telling you this part. And then she was like, well, that's the catch-22, you know, how do you get the job if you don't have the experience? And I said, that's every artist's moment. That's probably one of the puzzles that every person that's an artist is going to need to figure out for themselves. That is the challenge. You know, go to all the auditions, look at the choreographers you want to work with, you know, do whatever you need to do to show up as yourself. And then it will happen one day. And then she came back 2 years later and she'd been dancing with a smaller company for 2 years and she got to work with us, you know. Or I know she got put in the bank, and I think I had moved to a different department by then, but I think she got ended up on a show. And so the one is that letting yourself let in those people so that you can be surprised. And the people who show up after they've been chosen tend to be more collaborative, group-oriented people because they feel included. So then they start to show up, which is different than the ones who can just hold the leadership even in a stressful situation, the kind of front runners. But the other one is to think of, because at Cirque, we needed artists all the time for a long time, and we needed them. People don't understand that, but we needed them as much as they needed us. So to be in an awareness of the long-term relationship you're having with this pool of artists and a certain responsibility to be part of their development, you know, so that they can potentially be what you need, even if they're not that now. And to me, when I would open that window and someone had the guts to come up and ask, you're already a candidate to be seen again in 2 years. Because no matter how much she didn't want to show up, she gave me all the ways she didn't want to show up. And then she said, well, tell me why. And I'm like, okay, you had the courage to come up because you love dancing enough to ask, even though you're very embarrassed right now and disappointed.
Yeah. Yeah. There's like just enough curiosity, just enough wonder.
The heart can't help itself. You know, it's going to do it. And she loves it enough to say it's worth feeling that I might be, shamed even more than I feel.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Gosh, this has been so good. I could hang out on this subject for just another couple of hours. I know we don't have that much time. Yeah. Gosh, this is so much wisdom from just like one little tiny section of your long career, doing so many amazing things. Obviously, did other things at Cirque. You've gone on to found Kite Parade, your company. You're serving leaders and visionaries around the world in some amazing ways. We could spend so much time talking about that as well. I also, like, I'm desperate to talk about, because you're one of those friends that it's like, I never really just call you. I always check in first going, is this one of those months that you're talking?
yeah, that's true.
Because you do a lot of silent retreats. And, you know, it's interesting to me to also think about the work you're doing with visionary leaders around the world. And so much of that has to do with doing, playing, and yet it also has to do with being. Mm-hmm. And you have developed such an amazing practice at learning how to be a human being instead of just a human doing. And so that might be a fun way to kind of bring this conversation to a close is, you know, we look at all of the creativity and curiosity that has played a role in your career and all the wisdom that you've passed along to us. What wisdom and insight is there in the practice of being mindful, of meditating, of just being quiet for a little while? What has that taught you and what can we learn from it?
The easiest immediate answer in this context is being is deepening. Like you were, it was interesting when you said that there's a depth that you want this podcast to develop, or an exploration of depth. And I really liked that when you said it. I don't know why it is exactly, but there's very little relationship to self in the modern world. And depth of being is going into deeper and deeper layers of yourself. You know, at first, in a way, you're getting to know your personality, your preferences, all the things we've talked about that align your life. When you spend time going into silence, there's a whole reality that is, it isn't just your senses. It isn't just the way you think and thinking. And it's real. It's a real part of reality that I started doing this when I was very young, you know, by choice, like doing it as a decision. By the time I was 16, though, I was exposed to meditation before that. And I remember the first teacher I had said, for a year, you'll just do this and it'll be very hard. I did an hour a day. You'll mostly think, it won't even feel like you're succeeding or doing anything worthwhile. You'll start to notice after you leave the meditation that there's a shift in your presence, more relaxed, more able to respond in a calm and intelligent way to your environment. And then there'll be a moment when you'll kind of say, like, who is watching me thinking? And it's quite troubling when it happens because it's like, you see almost like you're dissociating. It's not self-consciousness. It's an awareness of what has been watching all this time. for me, it integrates eventually, and it's your inner part of yourself. And that's what I'm growing, if you like, or deepening is a better word. And I remember working with a client once and saying, can you just describe me? Because they were an overdoer, overworker. Definitely that was affecting all of their success. Mm-hmm. They had a lot of it. And I said, can you just describe to me the threshold of your outer and inner relationship to life and yourself? And as they tried, I understood there was no inner. There was only outer and sleep, and outer and sleep. And I mentioned that, and then, you know, we worked on it, or we began applying that. But it's very difficult to put into words, because words are, when it's not poetry or song lyrics, they're more mental as an expression of self. I mean, sometimes dance or things can express. But what you end up being able to express is what comes out of that depth. Mm-hmm. And for me, the deeper, the more playful. Mm. Those two for me are the two sides of my experience of being human. And it isn't even just that the deeper makes my playful better, or the playful makes my, it's some kind of organic formula. And what I notice over time is that when there's a call for that deepening, and then at some moment it comes out. And when it comes out, there's total ease in the external play and working with people or acting or like all, you know, all the things I've done in my life. And then there's a point when that starts to feel off, and then it's time to go back in. And that doesn't need to mean sitting in Vipassana. It's anything. It's dancing, walking in nature, playing with your kids if they're young enough. Eventually the world grabs them, you know, and then it all starts, like we said, the covering and the uncovering. It doesn't matter always that your eyes are closed or open. Sometimes this kind of strict meditation is needed to just crack into the inside. Mm-hmm. But it isn't for everybody. It's anything that we know the experience. It's an experience of life. Even though you could be moving, your stories about it have moved away and you're just experiencing it for that moment. You know, some people do it through psychedelics and other stuff. My experience is that if you need to go there without too many instruments and gizmos and tools and drugs and come back yourself for it to belong to you, to find a way to do it, you know? That's my experience. The other way, now you need that thing all the time. But people could say, I need meditation. But I mean, it's pretty natural. and so that, to that question, that's maybe unique to me. But there's an answer of the dance, you know? And I saw that helping many of the visionaries. And, you know, we're full circle. In essence, that's what we were talking about. When you are I could call it future because it goes far, but you're just with the motion and you like the motion and you want to know where the motion's going and you want to be part of where it's going. And those people need to remember the being, the deeper part that is still in the movement, you know, is still in this moment within the constant renewing of the moment. And so I started doing it more. I've also like slowed down marketing and social media things that, not because I think people couldn't do that. I don't think my work needs it as much as I thought. And so it started to feel like a kind of doing that wasn't making sense. And I could feel that. Mm-hmm. And so when I do my deepening, my appetite for that, and then it naturally moves out, I have a really easy sense of what's right for me and what's not. And a little less attached to whatever the identity is.
Yeah.
If it's time to let go.
Yeah. So good. So good. I know this is a big question. It's okay if you need to answer it slowly. When you hear me talk about the concept of living a wow level life, what does a wow level life look like for you?
I keep coming back to savoring it. So that's the thing, not missing, savoring it, and trust, which some people are saying surrender now, which is a bit of a different word, you know, is being spoken of. I think in the West, our interpretation of that word is, but trust in the sense of as much as you can trust, which is a willingness to see the intelligence in things, you know, and that includes yourself. So we talked about that a little bit too, that we do spend a lot of time seeing ourselves as a fix-it project. It's almost like we're born. And by the time the wonder is, you know, the age of wonder is wearing off, we'll go, whether it's into school or wherever it happens, that we're told now you have to change what you are, not just learn new things, but you actually don't know anything. And we're going to tell you everything now that you need to live a good life. And we're going to tell you it. We're not really interested in your ideas. You're going to memorize what we said, and then you're going to repeat it. And then we're going to go from there. And inherent in that is that you don't know. And yeah, a child doesn't know how to bake a cake until they're, you know, there's a tremendous amount of apprenticing and guiding and learning.
Sure.
But maybe we don't trust ourselves in a deepest sense, like that the way you were made is okay. That's how you were made, you know, and move from there and don't worry so much about it. And it's only you ultimately that can decide there's something you want to change because it doesn't work for you, not for somebody else. And the not missing is a relationship to the experience, savoring the experience, the happening of it. But the inner wow is being at peace with all of it, the inside and the outside, from a place of trust, which can evolve. You can still need to evolve, but you're not. My mentor Katie used to always say when people would talk about a problem or when they would describe how they were getting not feeling right, you know, and she'd start with, so are you having the wrong experience? Is that what's happening? And she didn't mean you're supposed to, you know, make it right. She was just wondering whether you were fighting what was happening rather than starting there and taking it where you want it to go. So that sense of spending a lot less time thinking things should be different, I still want to say different than wanting, feeling like you want to change something. You know, it's what it is and I want to take it here. But starting with this shouldn't be happening is, it's kind of like pops the bubble of wow, the balloon of wow, you know?
Yeah. Yes.
And the trick in that is go, I'm sitting here thinking this shouldn't be happening. That's exactly what's happening. Okay. You know, and like catching that background soundtrack of, you know, well, this, you know, like I'll tell one story. I did catch myself again in an airport once just because my energy was a bit low. Somebody turned to me and, you know, it wasn't going that well. The boarding was late and, you know, and it seemed a little disorganized. And, you know, someone turns to you and goes like, God, right? Like, you know, and you go, I know, like they're doing this. And last week, the same, you just get into a spiral of complaining, you know?
Yes.
And I caught it. Sometimes I don't, like everyone can know that. I catch it sometimes the next day. But as it was happening with them, I was like, oh, this is what I'm doing right now. Mm-hmm. It's not, this has nothing to do with what they're doing. This is what I'm doing with it, you know? And then I didn't go like, but you know, it's not that bad or anything. I just said, I said, I noticed that it's almost like I'm enjoying complaining. I know it's not true. They're doing the best they can. And I mean, there's worse things that could be happening, but I'm like kind of enjoying it. And she's like, thankfully she said, me too. And I was like, let's just complain. And then we did that for like 5 minutes till we were laughing. And then it was over. We were happy again, you know? So it's this trick of like always coming back to what's actually happening and taking it from there, you know, not being in a, it's like a gap you make. And if you can bring that gap together, you get back to wow pretty quickly.
Yeah. That's why I think wow, wonder, it's so intertwined with storytelling, specifically the stories that we tell ourselves. Yeah. You know, when Seth Godin read my book, that's what he said. He says, wonder is a story that we tell ourselves. And when he first said that, I was just like, whoa, I'm not comfortable with that. Like, it feels like you're belittling it a little bit. And then the more I thought about it, I was like, you're right. It is a story that we tell ourselves, and we have agency over the stories that we tell ourselves. We often assume that we don't, but we do. We are far more powerful than we realize. And that's what I love about what you're saying.
When we change the story, I think you've said this in different ways a few times, it changes the inner narrative and experience, and then it can actually change the outside, which is when people say what I seem to glean is that when people say you make your own reality, they mean partly the inner perception of it. But what we talked about earlier, when you can change the perception, it doesn't just like whoosh, you know, like fairy wand all change, but you begin to see the things that would facilitate it changing for you.
Yes.
And that's where I think there are things we don't control. So there are just a bunch of things that we don't control. And the thing we do, though, is that story of wonder. And it first changes how we feel. And then it can actually allow us to see and act on something that will change the actual external.
Yes. Yes. So cool.
I guess we have to stop.
At some point. I could talk to you for hours.
The battery's down at like 22. We went from 100 to 22.
Well, I have the privilege of considering you a mentor, and I've learned so much from you. I hope that I have the opportunity for that learning to continue. And it's just a joy to let others listen in and learn from you. For those who are doing so and they're going, gosh, I've got to learn more from Jillian, what's the best way to follow along?
Yep. It's my Instagram, which is my name, Jillian Farabee. Okay. And you can write me there. That's probably DM the best way.
I see you popping up on LinkedIn from time to time as well.
Yes. Yeah. LinkedIn's really good because that actually gives you more of my story the details of my resume. Yeah. LinkedIn or Instagram are the two. I mean, Instagram's private now. So LinkedIn's the best one. But
cool.
My name is where you find me in places. I don't have a name. And I just want to thank you for, it's just the chemistry between us. It's all, for the first times we talked, I guess we open each other's wonder. And I always learn something. You ask me a question, then as I'm answering, I'm like, oh yeah. I've even had moments where I write it down afterwards and go, you remember that, sweetie, because you do that sometimes, but you could do it more. And I'm really curious for the six cities and the things we talked about. And as much as it might be challenging sometimes, your excitement at creating new things in the world and just going for it, like for some reason, I'm thinking of Charlie Chaplin right now. I don't know why, but somebody who just didn't change like what they wanted to do. They just did it bigger. They didn't do anything other than make it go bigger. And I do really believe in what you're doing very strongly. And I did from the first time. And I know there's more people in the world that need it and want it. No question. A lot more. So I'm excited that you're doing that.
I appreciate that. That's very, very kind of you to say. It is dangerous when we get in the same room because we will never go to bed. I have so many memories of standing in a hotel lobby going, I got to go to bed soon. And you're like, me too. And then it's like, okay, but just one more thing. And then 3 hours later, it's like 2 a.m. and we're still standing there in the hotel lobby talking.
Exactly.
Yeah, so grateful for you. Thank you for your kind words and the generosity of your time. In closing, is there anything that I haven't asked you that you would want to leave with this audience listening in?
No. I mean, I don't think it's our last conversation, so... I think we covered a lot.
So to be continued.
But, I'm sure people could write you if they had burning questions. But if they like this, I think it will probably happen again and just hang around and it'll happen again.
Love it. All right. Well, to be continued. We'll look forward to the sequel.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. Bye.
By now, I hope you have fallen in love with Jillian as much as I have and can understand why I am drawn to the magic that just seems to ooze out of her soul. She is an extraordinary person, an incredible friend. She's been such a profound insight and source of wisdom for me. And again, I think so much of it comes down to her innate curiosity, that childlike curiosity that we have as children that is still intact for her. She has kept her wonder wide awake, and that wonder is constantly being put to work, and it comes out in the form of curiosity, which again, I think is just wonder in action. So if there's anyone who has taken wonder from this momentary, seemingly fleeting feeling that we experience sometimes in the highs of life and solidified it as a way of being in the world, it is folks like Jillian that you just heard from. And I was so grateful that she was willing to sit down and join me for that conversation. I hope it inspired you to get more curious. All right, next week, I'm going to be sitting down with Kate again, my sort of co-host from time to time here on the Wild Level Life podcast. And if you're inspired by this conversation with Jillian, get ready, because Kate and I are going to have a conversation where we try to extract some of the wisdom and lessons and actionable insights from this subject and conversation with Jillian and make them even more actionable so that you can put your own wonder to work by showing up with more curiosity in your own life. And so stay tuned in for next week. That's all I've got for you for this episode. As always, thanks so much for your ratings and reviews. This is a new podcast. We're experimenting with this new format here in season one. Your feedback means the world to us. So whether that's in the form of a rating or review or preferably leave the good stuff as a rating and reviews and send the feedback, the constructive criticism directly to me via email. And so that way we can learn from it and we're going to improve quickly here in this podcast. And so if you have thoughts, feedback, whether it's good or bad, I'm just a short email away. I promise I will read your email and reply to it. My email address is simply harris@astoria.com. That's Harris, H-A-R-R-I-S, at I-S-T-O-R-I-A.com, harris@astoria.com. I will reply. I would love to hear from you. And as you give us feedback or thoughts, or it could just be a simple note of encouragement, like, hey, I'm loving the podcast. That is helpful to us. We genuinely want to hear from you, and we are so grateful that you would take a moment of time out of your busy day to send that to us. But we'd also love to hear your questions. What are you thinking about? How is this making a tangible difference? What are your questions? And if you send them, we'll answer them here on the show. And so please don't hesitate to shoot me a quick note. I look forward to hearing from you. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening to the Wow Level Life podcast. As always, I am Harris III. I'm grateful for you and your willingness to come on this journey with us as we try to inspire you, ignite your curiosity, set your creative soul on fire so that you and I and everyone listening in can live Wow Level lives together.